This is episode 76 of Paranormal Stories. This week I'm reading from three books. Kevin Randall's book, The Washington Nationals, Flying Saucers Over the Capitol. Peter Panagor's book, which is called Heaven is Beautiful. And Jesse Desmond's book, Saucers of the North, A History of UFOs in Alaskan Airspace. When I have guests on my podcast, I read their books to work out questions for the episodes. And when reading these books, I always find such fascinating information that never makes it into the podcast. And here I give you a chance to get a peek into the books. I'll put a link to the books in the show notes, and I did seek permission to record the extracts from the books from the authors, and they kindly said yes. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe. So I'm going to start by reading from Kevin Randall's book, and this comes from chapter 3, which is entitled July 19 to 20, 1952. And this is what Kevin has written. The Washington Nationals, so named because the radar facilities in which the majority of the sightings were made were located at Washington National Airport, began there. According to the CAA's, that's the forerunner of the Federal Aeronautics Administration logbook, two radars at the Air Routing and Traffic Control Center picked up eight unidentified targets near Andrews Air Force Base at 11:40 p.m. on the evening of July 19. Air traffic controller Edward Nugent spotted seven blips clustered together in the corner of his radar scope. Nugent believed that they were in an area about 15 miles south-southwest of Washington, D.C. These were not airplanes because, at one point, they accelerated far faster than conventional aircraft could fly. First, they moved along at only 100 miles an hour, then suddenly would seem to accelerate to fantastic speeds. One of the objects was tracked, according to the calculations made at the center, at 7,000 miles an hour. In 1952, there was nothing that could fly at that speed that would be in the skies above Washington, D.C. Nugent then called the senior air traffic controller on duty, Harry C. Barnes. Barnes later wrote, "We knew immediately that a very strange situation existed. They, the unidentified blips on the radar, followed no set course and were not in any formation, and we only seemed to be able to track them for about 3 miles at a time. The individual pip would seem to disappear from the scope at intervals. Later I realized that if these objects made any sudden burst of extremely high speed, that would account for them disappearing from the scope. And that would put them in the range of the 7,000 mile an hour bursts noticed by Nugent. The first thing for the controllers to do was to check the radar equipment to make sure that it was functioning properly. Two other controllers, both trained in basic maintenance, found nothing wrong with the gear. Barnes then called his counterpart at the airport at Tower Central. The facility was located about a quarter of a mile away, on the same airfield, and if the radars at the ARTC were malfunctioning, those at Central should not be affected. Howard Coughlin told Barnes that they had spotted and were tracking the same objects that he was. Coughlin also said that he had looked out of the windows of the control tower and saw one of the objects high overhead. He described the object later as a bright orange light, but he could see no shape behind the light and could offer no other details about it. Barnes next called Andrews Air Force Base, now known as Joint Base Andrews, which is nearby, and asked if they had anything on their radars, but was told that the only thing they were tracking was a C-47 that was about an hour away from Washington and scheduled to land at Andrews. The radar operators weren't seeing anything out of the ordinary on their screens. Moments later, Barnes made another call to Andrews and suggested that they look outside because there was something strange in the sky near the Air Force Base. Airman William Brady looked out to the south and saw what he later described as an object which appeared to be like an orange ball of fire trailing a tail. It appeared to be about 2 miles south and 1.5 miles from Andrews range. It was very bright and definite and unlike anything I had ever seen. He tried to get others in the Andrews facility with him to look to verify the sighting, but even as he shouted at them, the brightly glowing object stopped moving and then just seemed to vanish. According to Brady, it took off at an unbelievable speed as it disappeared in a split second. Moments later, according to Brady, "I saw another one, same description. As the one before, it made an arc-like pattern and then disappeared. Only saw each object for about a second." Again, he was the only one to see either of these objects. No one else in the tower saw any of those lights, even with Brady's help. Later, there would be other sightings in the tower, but for the moment, Brady was alone in his observations. That might have been a result of the events happening so quickly, or it might have been that what Brady thought unusual was nothing more mundane than stars seen through a thin layer of haze that would periodically obscure them. That suggestion would later be offered by Air Force investigators as an explanation for his sightings. Joseph DeBoves, who was also on the scene as a civilian control tower operator at Andrews, said that Brady became excited during one of his telephone conversations, yelling, "There one goes!" DeBoves believed that Brady was watching nothing more interesting than a meteor. On the other hand, there is a memo in the Project Blue Book files that notes a sighting from the ATRC, that is Washington National Airport, at about 12:30 a.m. of an orange disc about 3,000 feet at 360 degrees due north. That could be independent confirmation of Brady's sightings made at Andrews and evidence of something more real than an illusion. Just after midnight, Airman Second Class Bill Goodman called the Andrews Control Tower to tell them he was watching a bright orange light about the size of a softball that was gaining and losing altitude as it zipped through the night sky. This seemed to be further confirmation that something unusual was in the sky over the Washington, D.C. area, and it seemed to corroborate the visual sightings made by Brady. About 2 in the morning on July 20, the radar officer, Captain Harold C. Way, at Andrews Approach Control, learned that the ARTC had a target east of Andrews. He went outside and saw a strange light which he didn't believe to be a star. He said that he thought it was changing colours, from red to orange to green to red again. He said that it seemed to rapidly lose altitude and then climb again. Later, however, he went back out and this time, according to what he told Air Force investigators later, decided that he was, in fact, looking at a star. Bolling Air Force Base, another Air Force installation in the Washington, D.C. area, came involved briefly about the time Way went outside. The tower operator there said he saw a roundish object drifting low in the sky to the southeast of Bolling. There were no radar confirmations of the sighting. It did, however, now involve a third government facility in the sightings that were being made that evening. The ATRC radar operators at National Airport began to detect targets near Bolling and inform the tower operators, including Staff Sergeant Richard LaCava, the operations dispatcher at Bolling. In the mobile control tower, that is a truck-mounted control tower that can be repositioned around the airfield, Don Wilson spotted a round, white amber-coloured light that he believed was about 7 miles to the southeast of the airfield. He said that it was about the intensity of a star. It drifted slowly, and though visible for a few minutes, Wilson could see nothing other than the bright light. In still another sighting from that area, a guard going off duty saw, to the southwest, an object that he said looked to be the size of a golf ball, bright orange in colour. The object moved from the west to the northeast in a half-circle pattern and was travelling at such speed that I knew it could not be a jet aircraft. It would be hard to judge the altitude of the object because it seemed to lose and gain altitude. The object moved in this pattern several times and then disappeared to the west. From the time I saw the object and then lost it, I would say it was about 15 to 20 minutes. This meant that the guard had gotten a very good look at the object. There was no fleeting light seen this time for only a few seconds. Okay, so now I'm going to move to Peter Panikor's book, which is called Heaven is Beautiful, How Dying Taught Me That Death is Just the Beginning. And I'm going to be reading from chapter 14, which is called The Voice. And this is just as the near-death experience is starting. This is what Peter has written. I found myself in a vast, infinite darkness, in a place that was not a place, a place that was outside of time and eternal, a place where there is no thing, and yet I was a being, spherical, sort of, and I had life, but no breath. I was me, and I knew I was me, yet I had no flesh and no bones. It was curious, and I was unafraid. I could think and, as best I could, comprehend that I was still me. Better yet, I had no brain to interfere with my thinking. I was life, or energy, or soul. I was a being. My body was a ball of soul, a being ball, a ball of being, I was I. I could see, but I had no eyes. It was as if I could see with 10,000 eyes, or one eye in every direction at once. I was floating, and yet firmly in a vast darkness, a greater darkness that extended beyond sight in every direction. But the darkness was not dark. I could see it. I floated and was stable in the darkness, and I was alone. A gigantic doorway or gateway appeared, or maybe it was there all along and I'd just not seen it yet. This was what the entire experience was like. Maybe it had all been there my entire life, just beyond my vision, and I simply could not see it. Note here, I'm using words to describe what I remember, but I remember I had no brain, nor had I language. Neither exists on the other side. It was timeless there. I tell my story in this order because words must be placed sequentially, but there was no sequence of events. All I experienced may have happened at once. The gateway, the doorway, was 100 yards high and 70 yards across, if I had to guess. I could see a long, arching tunnel of darkness. It was very, very dark, leading away from the gateway to God knows where. The gateway and its tunnel or corridor pierced the greater darkness and was contained within it, but seemingly led beyond it or through it somehow. The doorway itself was shimmering and flowing like a waterfall, only it was not water and was simultaneously translucent and transparent. I reached out with my being to touch the shimmer, to feel it, and I did. I touched the shimmer with something like a hand, but I had no hand. The shimmer was alive. The gateway was alive. I felt the life in it. It was living energy. I felt the energy of life flowing in the shimmer, and I felt it flow into me. Simultaneously, I heard my name called from deep, deep inside me, and yet also from beyond me. I heard my name called, and it was not just my name Peter, or Pete, or Petey, or Petro, or any of the names I was called by those who knew me and loved me. It was Peter and more. It was my soul's name. And it was said with love beyond imagination, beyond comprehension. It was love that was real, and love that is reality. It was my true name, my real name, and the name that revealed me to me. It was, and is my name, that only God can speak. I heard my name come from outside of myself, but heard it inside myself. But it was not a word. At least, it was not spoken as a word in any way that I can say. Yet it was me. I was in the Word, and the Word, my name, was who I was. The scriptures teach us that to know the true name of a person is to have power over them. This is what happens in the story where Jacob wrestles with the angel and demands to know the angel's name. On the other side, my true name was called to me. I was called by my true name, and thus was completely and utterly in the power of the being that called my name. I belong to the one who made me, and suddenly I knew the truth of that and what it meant. My name was, and I suppose still is, the essence of my being, the ground of myself, the light of me, and the whole of life. There were no words spoken. There was no language. There was no sound. The voice that called my name came from outside me and was present to me and nearby, yet distant as well. I could not see the voice, but instead felt its imminence and immensity. It was not my voice that I heard, nor the voice of my unconscious or my conscience. I heard the voice of the Almighty deep inside my soul, beneath me, around me, beyond me, and the voice filled me with my name and, in the filling, knew me in totality. The voice knew me fully and completely, and there was no part of me that was unknown. I was revealed, fully revealed, in all my beauty and hideousness. Nothing could be hidden. Nothing of me was hidden. I had no choice in the matter. I was fully and completely known. And that was that. All of me, the whole of me, everything about me was completely contained inside my name. In saying the name, I was known. And in hearing my name, I knew that I was known. It was my true name that only God knows and only God can say. Every action, every love, every hate, every sorrow, every joy, every tear, every smile was there, and there were no dark and hidden corners with me. When I heard my name, I was revealed, and I knew God was completely present. How did I know it was God? Well, I just knew that it was, and it could be no other. I knew because God told me so in the very calling of my name. I knew that the knower knew me. It was instantaneously obvious that my Creator was there with me, calling my true name that I heard inside myself, inside my soul. I was creature. I knew in that moment I was made by my Maker. I was a created being made by the uncreated. I understood that God was right there beside me and fully with me, although I could not see God at all. God had no being, but was all being. I could still see the greater darkness and the gateway, but my sight turned within. I was on the doorstep, the threshold of heaven, and I knew to the core of my soul that it was Yahweh who spoke. The voice that spoke without sound or language communicated with me telepathically. The voice was neither male nor female, neither old nor young. The voice was pure and holy, and only love. Only love and beauty and light, Almighty Maker. There was total and complete communication without words, unencumbered by language. I heard with my soul mind. I heard with the ear of my soul. I heard with all of my being. I heard with my soul. Seeing, hearing, being, feeling, thinking, all was one to me. My true name filled me. It infilled me. The voice infilled me with a breath, with a gift undeserved of love, hope, joy, beauty, truth, charity, kindness, compassion, love, patience, beauty, love. And it was all one, indescribable, amalgamated combination. The gift was heaven filling me up inside my soul being, inside of me, the true and real me. I was on what I think of as the threshold of heaven, at the gateway, the proverbial pearly gate, and God gave me the undeserved gift of heaven within me. In this world of ours, here on earth, we separate love, hope, joy, beauty, truth, charity, kindness, compassion, love, into differentiated things. We individualize them. We have truth. We have love. We have beauty. We have joy. We have hope. We have charity. Each is a separate idea or action or experience, and sometimes they overlap. Not so in heaven. In heaven they are one. They are oneness. And they emanate from the divine who is oneness. Okay, so now I'm going to move on to Jesse Desmond's book. This is called Sources of the North, A History of UFOs in Alaskan Airspace. And this is what Jesse has written. In the December 1978 issue of Ideals UFO magazine, author John Love ventured up to Alaska. After hearing an incredibly bizarre encounter at a New York City UFO conference in 1977, to find some sort of strange story to write about, and instead wound up with a bizarre series of sightings that includes multiple animal mutilations. Mr. Love met a National Park Service ranger named Philip Machling while aboard a ferry, the MV Matanuska, along the Inside Passage. Mr. Machling told him about some local myths and about the area in general before divulging a story about a UFO sighting that he had in May 1977. He was camped out on the top deck in a sleeping bag, watching the stars in the clear sky. Briefly, the top deck is the top open deck, meaning it's open to the elements. The MV Matanuska is still in service to this day. While Mr. Machling was in his sleeping bag, he noticed several orange flashes across the sky at about 3 o'clock high, then nothing. He rationalized that it was simply meteorites. After an hour, the lights came back. There were 10 or 15 glowing circular craft that seemed to lift from the forest on shore of a nearby island. He noticed that they had a black stripe or belt around their midsections. Once they rose up, they headed north and only made a light hum. 2 weeks later, Mr. Machling was again on the ferry, travelling from Sitka to Juneau. He again opted to camp out on the top deck. He watched as two orange glowing UFOs came over the trees and started skimming the water, he said, the way seagulls do. He watched as they seemed to be searching for something until they seemed to scoop up a young killer whale. The two UFOs flew off quickly after that. The story continues, but not by Mr. Machling. In 1977, at a New York City UFO conference, John Love was approached by a group of five men who relayed an encounter they had during the summer of 1977 on a trip to Alaska. These five men were Jack Friedman, Sim Hanger, Jerry Horn, John Temple, and Mark Baker. They had decided to spend a month hiking an old gold rush route near Eagle and along the Yukon River. During their trip, they camped along a ridge where they had a nice view of the valley below. Jack Friedman, a trained pilot who had once taught night navigation to the Coast Guard, was first to wake up. He went to a nearby stream to wash up and stopped when he realized that a squadron of 15 to 20 circular craft were overhead. They glowed a warm orange color, and along their midsection was a black, non-illuminated band. Craft were about half a mile away, hovering over the valley. Friedman said he was stunned by what he was seeing, and he was just stuck in place. He watched one rise up from the valley below before they flew off in formation. By the time Friedman snapped out of his dumbfounded stupor and woke the others, the craft were gone. After telling the others what he had witnessed, the group made their way down the ridge to where Friedman thought one craft had rose up from. It took a few hours for them to get to the valley, but what they found made them all question what was going on. In an area with some tall grasses and a small willow trees, they found a circular indentation. The tall grass in the circle was swirled up clockwise from the center, and four triangular imprints were pressed 2 to 3 inches into the ground. Small trees and saplings had also been crushed. The group found feathery white filament on some leaves and grass at the edge of the circle that seemed to disintegrate when touched. They also found some strange black rocks, which Sim Hanger, a doctorate candidate in geology at Columbia University, decided to collect and take back with him to New York. The ghastly part of this site were the piles of mutilated animals. They were moose with no legs and their antlers removed, set aside in a separate pile. Elk with no internal organs, caribou slumped on the ground like popped balloons with no skeletons. Large grizzly bears with no eyes and no claws. There was a noticeable lack of blood in the area under each animal wound that they looked at. They decided to gather a few bones and the odd-shaped black rocks before leaving the site. As quickly as they were able, it took a few days, the men were able to reach the Canadian border where they made their first report. They were simply given some forms to fill out before a plainclothes man asked them to step into a small office to tell their UFO sighting. Despite the man taking a deep interest in their story and making an audio recording of it, he told the group that it was completely ridiculous and unreal. No one would ever believe them. When the group got to Anchorage from the Canadian border, Sim Hanger took the strange rocks to a research geologist at the Department of Natural Resources in Anchorage. The research geologist was baffled by the stones, which had symbolic markings on them and offered no explanation for them. Hanger planned on taking the stones, 12 in total, back to New York to be examined by people he knew at Columbia University and the National Science Foundation. When he arrived in New York, he found that someone had removed the stones from his luggage. As John Love worked his way through the inside passage, he gathered a number of sightings from locals. Some sightings were similar to what the National Park Service ranger had seen. Some sightings were from pilots who had seen UFOs while flying. One sighting by Mitchell Wu, captain of Last Licks, a salmon boat from Gustavus, led to a strange men in black occurrence. He called to a crewmate, Al Ziegler, a part-time meteorologist for the Department of Fish and Game, to look at the pulsating lights out on the horizon. Ziegler told him they weren't satellites or morning planets or weather balloons. They watched the lights do strange maneuvers close to the water. The boat crew hauled in a load of silver and king salmon as the lights zoomed away. All of the fish in their nets were without eyes. The next day, Wu said that a man flashing a federal ID came to the dock to speak to the crew. After a talk with the crew, the man told the crew to forget about what they had seen. Okay, so this week I've been reading from three books: Kevin Randall's book, The Washington Nationals, Flying Saucers Over the Capitol; Peter Panagor's book, Heaven is Beautiful; and Jesse Desmond's book, Sources of the North, A History of UFOs in Alaskan Airspace. If you want to buy the books, there is info and a link in the show notes. A great way to support the podcast is to sign up on Patreon. On the Past Lives Podcast Patreon, when you sign up for $5 a month, you get an extended episode every week. And for $2 a month, you get an extended episode every month. There's also a $12.50 Patreon tier, where every week you can get the extended episodes of the Past Lives Podcast and the Alien UFO Podcast extended episodes. Just go to patreon.com/pastlivespodcast or click on the button on my homepage at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. And just so you know, if you're a patron, you get a 25% discount when you book a past life regression session with me. And I'm offering a free consultation call, which can be booked on my website. And there is a Past Lives Podcast Facebook group, and if you'd like to join, you'd be very welcome. And if you enjoy the podcast, please leave a review. And be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.